Welcome back to the program. Joan Didion once wrote that we tell each other stories in order to live. Stories are how we understand the world and each other. It's what enables poets to extrapolate the world in a grain of sand, or journalists to report and explain events in ways that allow us to care and to comprehend. Few journalists have been as good at this job as my guest this morning, David Marinus. A Pulitzer Prize winner, the award-winning biographer of Bill Clinton, Vince Lombardi, and Roberto Clemente, he has helped us understand modern-day Vietnam, as well as allowed us to be present at the Olympics in Rome in 1960, which, with respect to race and gender, changed everything. David Marinus's new book is a collection of his work. It's entitled Into the Story, A Writer's Journey Through Life, Politics, Sports, and Loss. It is my pleasure to have David Marinus back on this program. David, thanks so much for joining us.
Jeff, I always enjoy being with you. Thanks.
Always good to have you here. This idea of much of what you've written of narrative nonfiction, is this something that, although it's important, that we're in danger of losing, of somehow truncating today in our soundbite and, 140-character culture?
Boy, isn't that a great question. I hope not. I sometimes, in my darkest fears, I worry that the human brain is mutating to a point where I won't have the patience or the ability to comprehend long-form narrative. I certainly hope that's not true, and I thought your introduction and the quote from Joan Didion was absolutely right on. My deepest hope and belief is that there will always, that no matter how journalism and nonfiction writing changes, two things will always remain, and the first is the human need for story, and the second is the necessity of sifting and winnowing for the truth through all the misinformation and disinformation and inaccuracies that are propounded in the world.
In that sense, have we lost sight a little bit or shifted our focus in terms of what journalism is supposed to be about? That we get mixed up between news per se, which is the events of the moment, and journalism, which is about the translation of, the conveyance of, that information into something that makes sense in the context of a story.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that, I think there is room for everything, but I think that the most vital role that that reporters, journalists, investigative writers, scientists, everybody, who tries to present the truth to the world, what I hope is not lost is the sense that it's important to try to find the reality and the truth, and that there, that everything isn't utterly political, ideological, and subjective, and that there is such a thing, and the pursuit of it is important, and that it's not just a recitation of an event. I mean, the perception is often not the reality, and when you're dealing in politics or anything else, and use of common sense, of diligent research and reporting, and of an open mind, that's what scientists do, and I don't know why. I think it's just as vital in every other endeavor in trying to present the world to people.
As you point out, objectivity is not just about presenting both sides equally.
No, absolutely not. And that's that's a fallacy and a hollow argument that sometimes newspapers have imposed on reporters, and fair and balanced reporting, which obviously has been in an Orwellian way distorted by a certain television network. If you're writing that the world is round and somebody says it's flat, the truth is it's round. That's the simplest, obviously, of all the many things you see in the world, but that's what you have to do, is try to find what is real.
One of the other things that you write about, and it's in the context of so much that you've written about individuals in your biographies and in other work, is the importance of sense of place. Talk
I believe deeply
that.
In that. And my first motto is go there. I've tried to do that with all of my books. I think that it's only through sort of the poetry of geography that you can get to the soul of something, and that we, in all events, are shaped by time and place in a very deep way. And it's the first thing that I try to capture when I'm writing a book, so that the reader will feel that they are there. And to do that, you have to go there. I think I've told you this story before, but, you know, when I decided to write the book on Vince Lombardi, I turned to my wife and said, how would you like to move to Green Bay for the winter? Last famous loving words. But we went, and I had to do it because the climatic event in his football life, the book is more than football, but in terms of football, it was the Ice Bowl, which was played in 17-degree below weather on New Year's Eve 1967. And I had to endure a Green Bay winter in order to be able to write that the way I wanted to. And it was very important in all of my books. Going to Arkansas and spending weeks and months there when I was doing Bill Clinton's biography, going to Kenya and Hawaii and Kansas and Chicago, spending a summer in Chicago on the book I'm doing now on Barack Obama and his family. In every sense, I think that geography is more than a map, and it explains quite a bit about each of us.
And explains quite a bit, not only in terms of reporting the story, but also in how those places shape those individuals.
Yeah, I mean, that's the key thing. It is how they shape those individuals. That's really, to get back to your first questions about objectivity and all of that, I mean, my obsession is to try to understand why people are the way they are, and the forces that shape them. I have as many biases and people I like and dislike, and my own feelings about politics and so on. But it's overwhelmed as a writer by my desire to understand anyone, and so. Place is part of that understanding and explains the forces that shape them. You can't understand Bill Clinton without really understanding Arkansas and the place that he grew up, and what he loved about it and what he tried to overcome from it, and how it shaped him both in a individual and a cultural way.
The other part of that, kind of the corollary of that, is something that you talk a lot about and write a lot about, which is this notion that there is good and bad pretty much in everyone. I mean, other than those individuals, you know, the Charles Mansons of the world, that we have to look at the good and the bad, and that in this polarized culture that we live in, it's harder and harder to do that.
Yes. And, I'm not naive about that. It's not that I'm trying to look at people with rose-colored glasses and say, but I think that there is an inherent tendency to portray things, people as good and bad, events as black or white. And each of us knows in our heart of hearts the contradictions in ourselves and what's good and bad about ourselves. And, you know, sometimes we say we hate something and in some part of us we love it, and some things we say we love, part of us hates, but we're not going to tell the world that. But all of us know that. And so we all know that a human being is full of contradictions. And that aside from people where the evil or whatever you want to call it is just overwhelming, and most of us have that, and that's what I'm interested in. I don't think you can portray the beauty of a human being without showing all of their flaws as well. I think it's all part of the same package, and I want to do that in the context, and it's really, really difficult in this modern American political culture to do that. It's almost why I decided not to pursue a book on Barack Obama, because I knew that whatever I find and however I write it, people will first I have to overcome whatever they're bringing to it in terms of what, you know, whether they think I'm trying to sugarcoat him or attack him, which I'm not trying to do either. I had to deal with that with Bill Clinton. I think that I fairly successfully overcame it from all sides in that regard in understanding him, and I hope to do the same with Barack Obama.
The other part of it is that in all of these stories, and all of these stories of individuals and even some of the broader work about Vietnam or the Olympics in Rome, that it is all part of a continuing story, that each of these things have to be understood in the context of a larger story.
Well, I'm glad that you see that. And I even, as I was putting together this into the story, the collection, in some subconscious way, I realized that all the stories I've written are part of a continuing story, which is, you know, in one sense, my perceptions of the world, but also the progression of time and place and humanity over the course of the 30 years that I've been writing it. So without sort of losing sight of either the character or the event that I'm writing about, I have an obsession with the context that surrounds an event, and that there's something before and after, and that all of it has a connection.
Even in terms of your work, I mean, you're writing about Barack Obama now. There's part of a connection there that comes even from Roberto Clemente and Jackie Robinson,
oh,
and
absolutely.
Those in the world of sports.
Yeah, and from Martin Luther King and Jesse Jackson. There's a story in my collection about Jesse Jackson in 1988 that when he was running for president, and really it's about his sort of difficult and fascinating relationship with Martin Luther King. King was killed in 1968. Jackson ran for president in 1988, 20 years later. And in that story I'm writing about in 1988, I talk about the 20-year cycles of history from 68 to 88, and Jackson talking about what will come next, and it was 20 years later that Barack Obama arrived.
The other thing that you talk about is looking for, as you put it, the universal in the particular. Talk a little bit about that, because it certainly applies to so much of your work.
Yes, and I guess that it's both a style, a technique, and something deeper. In my journalism, I'm looking for more than just sort of the cliche in journalism is to write a so what graph, meaning why do I care about this? And usually that's not very subtle. And what I'm looking at mostly is something else, which is not why do I care about this, but how do I connect to, you know, how do you connect the reader to it? And the way you do that is by presenting themes. And one of the themes in several of my stories about tragedy, you know, two of the stories in the book are, one is about 9/11, a reconstruction of what happened in the Twin Towers and in the Pentagon, and another is about the massacre at Virginia Tech. And in each of those instances, I was looking for the detail that any human being can connect to, which is the utter prosaic ordinariness of life until that single moment when it's changed forever. So I wanted the reader to feel what it was like to get off the subway in New York City and walk toward the Twin Towers and go up to the 102nd floor and be at your desk, and then what it was like to go all the way down the stairwell 100 floors to get out of that building. I wanted the reader to feel like what it was like to walk into to wait outside a classroom at Virginia Tech and talk to your teacher about the NFL draft. You're an Atlanta Falcons fan, and he's a a New Orleans Saints fan, and you're talking about who your team is going to draft. It's that sort of real, ordinary, everyday stuff that makes the reader immediately connect to the feeling that, wow, you were, you know, that's what it was like. And then I take them into the rooms at Virginia Tech or whatever. But it's the universal and the particular.
And, of course, that also creates a kind of existential angst, knowing that at any given moment the ordinary can become the extraordinary.
Well, we all sort of have to keep going. But, yes.
Talk about how that applies to the universal and the particular, how it applies also to the biographies that you've written. to Roberto Clemente or Bill Clinton? Or
well, most of the people I've written about are not are extraordinary individuals in one sense or another. But there are different places where you can connect to them. Roberto Clemente, for any of your listeners who don't know, was the first great Latino baseball player from Puerto Rico. He had to overcome language and race to succeed in Pittsburgh, the quintessential white, blue-collar steel town of America. And it's those themes that I'm most fascinated by. But one of the things that attracted me to him was that he was a hypochondriac. And so am I. But yet he was a perfectionist, and he didn't like being called a hypochondriac because of something else, which was that it was too close to an inaccurate stereotype of Latinos as being lazy, which he was not in any way, but he was always dying of some fatal disease. And so that's a little particular that I think has a universal appeal in its.
And with Clinton, it was really generational. It was really a representation of a generation.
Yeah, that's what attracted me to two things attracted me to the Clinton story beyond the fact that he was going to be president of the United States. Then the overwhelming one was that I saw in his life a chance for me to really sort of write about the Stations of the Cross of our generation, the post-war baby boom generation. He was 3 years older than me, but basically. You know, the whole 1950s, then civil rights and Vietnam and Watergate, all of that weaves through his life and the life of his wife, Hillary Rodham Clinton. And that's one of the things that attracted me to that story.
I want to talk about the two things that have been obsessions or interests of yours and that incorporate so much of this, which is sports and politics. And what is it about those two things that are of so much interest to you and that are so powerful in terms of this idea of narrative nonfiction?
Well, let me say first of all that I don't make a great distinction in terms of which one is has more meaning than the other. You know, some writers call sports the toy department, and I think some politics is trivial. I mean, I sort of enjoyed reading Game Change, the best-selling book this year about the campaign, but it's utterly trivial. There's no redeeming social value in it or anything beyond just the inside gossip of the campaign. And in sports, sometimes you can find something that has great sociological importance, and I've tried to do that with all three of my books without exaggerating, just showing how sports has changed American culture, particularly in terms of race and gender. So I don't make that great distinction, but I do find that through both politics and sports, you can have an inherent narrative arc, a drama, which is what I call the discipline of the work, and then you have the freedom within that to explore a lot of fascinating issues. So you have both a dramatic arc to the story and an entree into a very interesting thematic parts of life.
Is there a difference, though, and it's something I think people have been talking about and a lot of people, including myself, have been thinking a lot about lately. Is there a fundamental difference in terms of politics and sports in that sports, to a certain extent, although the issues and themes can be larger, the work is an end in itself. With politics, it is not the end, that governing is the end and that it is part of a process. And in that way, they're different, and in that way, there's a danger of applying the sports metaphors to politics.
Well, I think you have to just, yes. And politics, I mean, I don't, but you certainly can't separate governing from politics anymore. But, of course, you're absolutely right. And there's far too much. I'm not interested in politics per se. I'm not a political junkie in terms of polls or elections or any of that. But I'm interested in why decisions are made, why people do what they do. And I think it's partly through the study of characters, but also of movements that you can understand that and the progression. And that has to do with governing and why certain decisions are made and how they're made. And yes, you're absolutely right in that regard. I mean, the day after a Super Bowl, who cares, you know? But the day after election, things really begin. That's a very important point.
Talk about that notion of moments, because you discussed that life is about moments.
Well, I think if you think about your own life, most days are forgettable. You know, it's just one day after another, but there are a series of days. You can't always predict when they are coming or how they will be there, but they're the days you remember. And that shape you, shape everybody around you, that you learn from and build from, and, you know, either for good or bad, or, you know, joy or sorrow, or, you know, intellectual deepening somehow, something you've heard or read or somebody you've encountered. And I think that's what life really is, those sensations.
The other part of it is, though, we learn from those moments, and Clinton may be the penultimate example, and you've written a lot about this, but that while we learn from those moments, there are elements of our character that will keep repeating themselves no matter what we do.
You know, I believe in free will. I'm not a fatalist. but as a biographer, and I've seen repetitive patterns in people's lives, I think it was Marcel Proust who said that human beings don't change, they only become more so. I have seen individuals change and grow and learn, but there are also, along with that, characteristics in each of us that keep recurring.
And, of course, with Clinton, there the same themes repeat over and over.
Yeah, well, with Clinton, it was loss and recovery. Mm-hmm. And I think it will go on until the day he dies. It certainly played out through his presidency, and I wrote about it in the biography, which ends before he becomes president, but it was predictive that when he was down, he would find his way back, and when he was on top, he would be, you know, the seeds of his own self-destruction would evidence themselves. And my book came out right when he was at his low point, when Newt Gingrich was ascendant in February of 1995, and my publisher at the Post, Don Graham, put his arm around me and said, "Nice timing, Meredith. Nobody cares about this guy." But I knew from the study of his life that he would figure his way back, and then something else would happen, and then he'd recover from that.
How has this process of understanding so many of these other lives, the people that you've written about, the stories that you've done, that even the people that are ordinary people that you wrote about at Virginia Tech and that were involved at 9/11, how has that shaped you? How has that transformed who you are, David?
Well, I think I've always been an empathetic person, and that seeps through in my writing. If anything, my sensibility about people that at earlier points in my life I might have just dismissed, I think I look for more in everyone in terms of why they do what they do. I guess the most profound example of that actually is my Vietnam book, Jeff, where I spent a lot of time with soldiers, and I was against the war. I wanted nothing to do with the Vietnam War. I was on the other side of that whole issue, and yet in doing that book about these soldiers who had survived a horrendous battle in Vietnam, I became very close to them, and that sort of opened up a side to how I look at not just issues of war and peace, but of choices that are presented to each individual and how they deal with them that I hadn't really thought about much before.
David Marinus, the collection of his stories is in his new book, Into the Story, A Writer's Journey Through Life, Politics, and Sports and Loss. David Marinus, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
My pleasure, Jeff. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
You.